Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services, Monday, March 4th. Just a few more months and then we'll be all done. I'd like to open, first of all, before I open anything, Senate Bill 274 is being taken off the agenda. There is a House Bill 3000 that is, it has to do with vision and screenings and examinations, and there is a consensus bill, House Bill 3000, on the House side, so we've decided we'd rather go that route than deal with it over here. So that is off the agenda. And I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 101. Sandy, remind us what's happening here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 101 had a public hearing on the 11th of February. You'll recall that this eliminates from the impaired health professional program the requirement that employers of the program participants establish a minimum training requirement for the supervisors of the participants. It removes the admittance to the hospital for mental illness and court ruling of mental incompetence from the list of information that the program must report as evidence of substantial noncompliance within that diversion agreement. We have a dash one amendment, which is retaining the ability of a licensing board to require supervisory training if they so desire. We have there's no fiscal impact on the dash one and no revenue impact on the dash one, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment, Senate Bill 101.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 101. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 101 as amended by the dash one amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 101 to the floor with due as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sandy, could you, I was kind of focusing on some other things when you happened to describe what the dash ones do. Could you tell me again?
Yeah, the dash one amendments, Senator Shields, are retaining, it adds the language that retains the ability of the licensing board to require supervisory training. It's not mandatory, but it's a voluntary action. The nurses, I believe it was the Nurse Association that had requested that be put in place.
Good, thank you.
You're welcome.
And colleagues, this is our only nurse nurse impairment. That's what I have. there are some impaired health professional bills on the House side, and this is just a very small piece of it, but the majority of work I think is going to be done on the House side.
We'll probably have to fix when it gets over here.
That's right. So is there any further discussion? The clerk will call the roll. Oh, she's excused.
Senator Knuth?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill. I'll close the work session of Senate Bill 101, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 470.
Did you want to go down again, Senator Cruz?
Or do you want to speak from up here?
These were the leftovers from last time.
Mr. So we need to just bring Tom up.
And then,
After.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll let Tom talk, and if he misses something, I'll fill in the gaps. So I thought, Rob, do you need to come back up? You were going to be in court today, so.
Well, you got sick. So here, you're stuck with me.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 470 and the three amendments that are currently in front of the committee. I think to get an understanding about this bill, I want to take you back a little bit and tell you a little history. You passed in 2009 the authorization for us to create a prescription drug monitoring program. It took us 2 years of hard work to find the right computer system that guaranteed the privacy, gave us the flexibility to expand the program if we ever wanted to expand the program, and to put in place a system that would really work for health in this state as opposed to law enforcement. And I, as Mr. Ovette said last week, this really is designed to be a health tool for providers. The program went live in September of 2011, so we have about 12 to 15 months worth of experience under our belt for it. And we have 98% of the pharmacies reporting, so we are pretty comfortable we're getting all of the data. We have over 5,000 providers who have signed up to use it. We get more than 80,000, I believe that's the number. We get a huge number of hits every month from providers going in to look up the data for patients that they have in front of them. Because we have some experience now, we did a survey to ask the providers what it was that they really wanted changed in the program. We got some interesting answers back. One is, they said, could you give us some additional data points? They pointed out that perhaps Jeff Cruz or Tom Burns are fairly obviously male, but who is or what is Terry Burns, male or female? We don't collect the sex of the patient, and so that's one of the things that we wanted to add. We also wanted to add, they asked for, what does it mean when it says that they got 30 tablets of a drug? Is that a one-day supply, a one-month supply, a one-week supply? They want to know what the provider was looking for when the provider distributed 30 tabs so that the other provider who has in front of them knows, oh, this person may have picked it up 2 weeks ago, but they don't have the pills in their possession anymore because they're no longer using it. The other one that became important is, what do we do with people who are shopping insurance companies? Either they have a cash convert, they want to pay cash for their drugs, or they are paying cash because their insurance company doesn't cover the drug, or they're paying cash because they don't want the insurance company to know that they're covering the drug. We wanted to know what the source of payment was. So those are three things that they said they wanted added to the bill. The other thing that came loud and clear is, with all due respect to doctors, they think they're really busy and really important. And they spend a lot of time talking to us as patients, all 15 minutes. Signing into the system takes 5 or 6 minutes. So if they sign into the system to look up Tom Burns when Tom's in the office to pull up my patient profile, it's 5 or 6 minutes of time they're not spending talking to me. So they asked, could they delegate somebody in their office to specifically give that person authority to go in under their own account? The doctor is still responsible, but under their own account, meets all the requirements, under their own account to go in and pull the and pull patient data in advance and put it in the patient file, so when the doctor walks into me, he already has it in front of him. He's read it as he walks down the hall. The other thing that we wanted to do was to allow the opportunity for our providers to look up their own DEA number. Right now, if you're going to prescribe one of these products, you have to have a DEA license. A number of the providers came to us and says, we believe our number has been stolen, is being used by somebody else, is being counterfeited. We don't know, and we'd like to be able to see who is prescribed, what drugs are being filled on our DEA number so we can alert the appropriate authorities so we can take the appropriate actions to stop that practice. The other thing is our state medical examiner. You know, we hear about all these deaths that are occurring from prescription drug overdoses, but our medical examiner, the people who actually have to certify the death, don't have access to the data. So sure, they can go in and look at the medicine cabinet and say, oh yeah, Tom had all these pills, but when did Tom get the prescription? How long has Tom had the prescription? If there's a bottle, has he taken 100 pills because it was a 200-pill bottle? They don't have that kind of data. They are not allowed to have access to that kind of data. Their only opportunity is to talk to the family, and oftentimes the family doesn't know the answer to the question. So by looking this up, they can actually know for sure what it is that may have caused the death of the patient or the death of the person they're working with. So that's your main bill. There's then the three amendments that came to us after we wrote this bill, and the amendments came, frankly, because this bill started as an administration bill. And we moved it through the process, and the senators asked if they could be the sponsors of it. So it was written back in July. We've had a number of ideas that was brought to our attention to that really do improve it. Number one is give the Board of Pharmacy the ability to add drugs to the list. We currently get schedules 2 through 4, but there are a number of drugs that are very definitely subject to abuse that are not in schedule 2 through 4. And so the Board of Pharmacy, through its normal public board meeting process, could say, we think this drug is at such high risk that we want it monitored. The other thing is it allows the program to build algorithms to alert doctors. Hey, doctor, you want to be aware that you are looking at a patient who may or may not have an abuse problem. Or, doctor, you may be aware, you ought to be aware that that a patient of yours or a client, a patient of yours has suddenly shown up 4 times in a pharmacy over the last 24 hours. Some sort of algorithm about that. Again, it's notice to the doctor to say to the doctor, doctor, you ought to be aware of what's going on. And then the last thing is, with our borders, as much as we like to think that everybody loves Oregon and stays in Oregon to get their health care, a lot of people will work in Vancouver, in the Tri-Cities, in the Boise area for Ontario, where they see providers in that state. They are Oregon residents, and the providers in that state would like to be able to look at our data. And so the Dash 7 amendments allows those providers meeting exactly the same criterion that we have to look at Oregon residents and the data that may be available for on those Oregon residents. That's the bill. That's the 3 amendments. And I will be happy to answer any questions you may have specifically about the bill or the amendments.
Comments? Yes, Senator Cruz.
I may have a couple. I think Tom did a very good job of defining what it is we're after, but I just kind of as a background, Tom and Rob and I were part of a group that went to Montgomery, Alabama this summer. It's not a place you want to spend your summer at, but we were there. Because prescription drug abuse has become a national epidemic, and actually the National Governors Association has made this one of their top priorities. And so we were back at a meeting. How many states were there?
Seven.
We were one of 7 states at this meeting, and we were sharing ideas on how we get on top of this. And this program is one of the things that kept raising to the top as far as we were concerned. And so a lot of the ideas and a couple other bills that are floating in this session are the outgrowth of that effort. And you know, my comfort level at this point in time, we look at how some of the other states have structured their prescription drug monitoring program. I think we have the best one as far as our ability to contain the information and have security around the data. And you know, there was talk back there about going national with this, and we are going to object and fight that at all costs. This is an Oregon program, and it needs to stay Oregon specific. And really, colleagues, what this bill and these amendments do actually is, I think, going to make the system work better, more efficiently, and give providers the information they really want. This is all about patient safety, and I think this medical record thingy we are doing here is going to save lives.
Mr. Burns, I have a question on the Dash 7s. When I read it, a provider in California, Idaho, or Washington will be able to access this, but it doesn't say, I assume it is, but they must have a patient in Oregon. And I wanted to get that in the record, because when I read this, I assume that it's probably defined in ORS 689.005, but I just want you to make sure that you get that on the record.
Madam Chair, I fully understand your concern, and it is for an Oregon resident only. Washington provider providing services to an Oregon resident.
Yeah, if I could follow up, you know, there's talk about information sharing between systems. This is not that. That is a ways down the road, if we ever get there, because that involves the creation of interstate compacts, and we will have those discussions at some future time. But this is just allowing a provider to have information on a resident of Oregon.
Correct.
Okay. If you don't mind staying there, I'd like to ask Becky Strauss from ACLU to come up and give her testimony. And
you're in trouble now. You're between the two.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Becky Strauss. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. We are here in opposition, dare I say, strong opposition to this bill and to the Dash 1, 3, and 7 amendments. And I will try to go through quickly. Oh, I apologize. I should hand out my written testimony while I'm talking so you can. I've tried to map out change by change where we are, and I hope that some of my written testimony expresses our degree of opposition at each various change that's being proposed to the law. What I'd like to start by saying is that the most concerning thing for us right now is the timing of this expansion. There's been some reference to this, but I'd like to give it a little more attention to the lawsuit that's pending right now between the Federal Department Drug Enforcement Agency and the state of Oregon. As you all know, in 2009, when the PDMP was set up, this legislature made a commitment, and that commitment's been reiterated in these hearings, to the PDMP not being a law enforcement tool. And part of that commitment was expressed by a search warrant requirement for law enforcement to get access to anything in the database. What has happened since then are at least two occasions that we know of where the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency has come in with administrative subpoenas, which is, it's a much lower bar than the probable cause bar that a search warrant requires, to access this information. In one instance, that information was released to DEA. In another instance, of which we are aware, the state of Oregon and the PDMP said, we have a probable cause requirement, refused to hand over the records, and those parties are now in court. Trying to figure out, and the court will rule eventually on whether the federal administrative subpoena trumps our state search warrant requirement. As you may also know, our office, the ACLU of Oregon, has filed a motion to intervene in that case, asserting that the DEA's use of administrative subpoenas to access patient and prescriber records is also an unlawful invasion of privacy, regardless of where the court goes on the preemption issue. So I mention that all to say that it was certainly our fear when these discussions were happening in 2009, and now it's been confirmed that the privacy is not secure of these private medical records that are part of the PDMP. And so if anything, as we contemplate this, I urge the committee to hold off until we know where that case is going to go, until we know the certainty of the security of these records. So that I'd like to just mention to frame the rest of my comments, and then I'll go through each of the changes that are being proposed. Section 1, in regard to the additional data points being collected, first, there's a typo in my written testimony. I'm not actually referring to source of income, but source of payment is being proposed to be added to the points being collected. Again, I'll reiterate, we're worried about more information about people being collected as a policy point. And I think in regard to collecting more information, there will always be this balance of the privacy rights of the patients and the doctors, the information that's needed to identify a patient at that point of contact, and then a risk of over-reliance on a false positive. If we have more information, are we more assured that we are finding the right patient?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Actually, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Becky, but your point, I want to make sure I understand the purpose of this, and my question then is to Tom. So help me understand how the shopping insurance issue operationalizes itself and why that's important.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, the system only works if the doctor has all of the information in front of him to have a conversation. And if the doctor only has half the information, that is half the prescriptions that are filled, is not aware of the fact that the patient is paying cash for a lot of drugs that he thought were being billed to insurance companies. He's not going to know that there may be something going on. He may choose to look at this and say, this makes perfect sense. I recognize why the patient is doing this. This is some reason, the reason why the patient made this decision. But it also gives another tool for the doctor to simply have a conversation, say, Tom, I see that you've been picking up patients' prescriptions that are potential for abuse for cash. Is there a reason why? And it may lead to a conversation that becomes a health conversation.
Can I make a follow-up? I guess I don't understand the distinction and why that's important to getting, putting structures in place so that people aren't enabled in their addiction. If a person is paying cash, they'd still have to get the prescription from the provider. If they had it insured, they'd still have to get the prescription from the provider, and that presumably they would give a 7-day supply in either regard. So I'm not sure why that information is useful in getting between the addiction and the addict.
Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields, you have to recognize that patients see multiple providers. And if a patient is going down the path of abusing, the patient is going to see multiple providers. And so the provider that is currently the patient is in front of, the only information he has is what is in front of him from the PDMP and what the patient chooses to share. And he doesn't know what he know. He can see the prescription was picked up. He can see the patient has 100 tabs or 10 tabs or a 7-day supply. Well, he doesn't know it's a 7-day supply. He knows he has 30 tabs. It could be a 7-day supply. Having the ability to know that was paid for by cash would allow him to say, is there some other reason why you don't want this information to be shared with your insurance company? Is there something occurring between that the other provider should know about? It simply gives one more opportunity to have a conversation.
Follow-up, Madam Chair, if I could, and then I'll let you get back to your testimony, Becky. So, I mean, it seems to me the most important thing is that the provider be able to know that they're seeing numerous providers, right? Mm-hmm. So that they might not even know about. I haven't really thought about this in detail since the previous legislative sessions. Can the providers see that they have multiple providers, or can they only get that information from the pharmacist?
No, they get the Senator
today, as it is.
Yeah,
today.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Shields, they get the information from the program, which has every prescription that is filled. Connected with that is the fact that Dr. A gave Tom the prescription, and Dr. B gave Tom a prescription, Dr. C gave Tom a prescription. It could be that they're all the same prescription. It could be that they're different prescriptions, different amounts, different reasons. So the Dr. A, who Tom is in front of today, does know that B and C has issued prescriptions.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And on that same point, I still don't see why you need to ask for source of income.
Not income, payment.
I meant payment. I'm sorry, payment.
Yeah. Again, it's just another tool to have a conversation with the patient to make sure that you understand why is it that you are buying all these products off your insurance company. Your insurance company not covering your benefit. The insurance, are you trying to hide something? It's just another opportunity to gain another data point to have a conversation with the patient.
The private provider. Maybe that's what you were getting at.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is the most important information is, hey, look, I know you're seeing six doctors or six nurse practitioners. I don't know if that gives me any additional information to say, well, you paid with my prescription with cash rather than using your insurance. I think I already know you have a problem because you've lied to me about the other five providers. So I guess that's just an area that I'll need some more persuasion on.
Okay. All right, continue, Becky.
Thank you. I'll move on to Section 2. This is the piece that's proposing to allow for delegation to staff by practitioners or pharmacists. Just mention a couple things. What I've seen, I have this kind of national survey that I'm sure many of you all have looked like that explores different PDMP systems in different states and kind of what they're doing. So what I found is that very few other states are delegating with just complete open access. There's usually some type of sidebar like You can delegate to one staff person, or you can only delegate to someone who holds a professional license. The concern, obviously, is that when professional staff, like a pharmacist or a practitioner, are delegating to someone else in the office, you're not only opening up to more people who can access the information, but there is less accountability for those people. I think particularly in a practitioner's office, where some of the administrative staff may not have a professional license, I'm very worried that the accountability goes away. I know that Mr. Burns stated that it would not. I'm hoping that maybe we're all just on the same page and that we can clarify in the statute that the person who does delegate is still responsible for the actions of the person that they delegate to for unlawful access of the database. The other thing I would mention there is, having sat in many of the PDMP Advisory Commission meetings over the interim, it seemed like, and really reiterated by testimony today, it seems like the issue is the practitioners wanting to delegate. So I'm not sure why the statute is proposing to delegate to practitioner staff and pharmacist staff. If we have 98% of the pharmacies on board, and the problem has really come from the surveys from the practitioners, I might suggest that we focus on the practitioners. Also in Section 2, allowing for the functionality for a practitioner to search by a DEA number, I think this is concerning because it's using the PDMP as a law enforcement tool. They're really... What the intent of searching by a DEA number is to look up misuse of the DEA number by someone else and report that misuse. That's kind of, in our view, an erosion of the intent and the function of the database.
For a practitioner to be searching by a DEA number, how does that roll into law enforcement? I don't understand that. This is protected information. So how does that impact law enforcement? I mean, they can't, they can't do that and then go to Rob Bovet and say, ooh, looky what I found. That's not allowed in this thing.
Senator Moniz Anderson, Senator Cruz, I think they actually could.
Oh, say your name
if a doctor actually looked up...
Your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, Rob Bovet, District Attorney from Lincoln County. This particular provision is not meant to enhance law enforcement access to the PDMP. I won't be able to get it. This is practitioners looking up their own DEA number because they're suspicious that somebody else is using their DEA number unlawfully. There's exemptions from HIPAA, frankly, all federal statutes that I'm aware of, that when a doctor becomes aware of somebody committing a crime, which using the doctor's DEA number, then they can turn it over to law enforcement and say somebody's illegally using my number. So in that way, it would be a doctor referral to law enforcement, but it's not law enforcement searching up the DEA number.
Well, it's actually dealing with a compromise in the system. It's not compromising the system.
I would argue it's not compromising at all. It's just empowering a doctor to know who's writing prescriptions on that doctor's tab.
Rob, but that's the point. You know, I'm a doctor. I'm looking at my DEA number, and I'm seeing all this stuff that I didn't do, and I report it. I haven't compromised the system, but to a degree, somebody who has stolen my DEA number is potentially compromising the system. So, I can't go look for Tom Burns' DEA number. All I can do is go look for my own. So I'm it's a tool to allow me to make sure that everything that's happening under my watch is what should be happening under my watch.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that's what I'm getting at. Would it also allow the provider across the street to look at my DEA number?
No.
And so then, Becky, your concern is just that having this tool available, that if there's a field that you could punch in a DEA number, it would just be one little bit easier for law enforcement if they, provided the subpoena to look up somebody's prescribing history, that would give them the tool to do so?
Chair Moniz Anderson, Senator Shields, I think the point that I'm making is not necessarily that the information would be accessed directly by law enforcement and searched by a DEA number, but that it would be eroding the original intent of the database. This is now using it for some enforcement purpose, albeit enforcement of someone who may be misusing a DEA number. That's the point I'm making.
I'm trying to understand, Becky. So you don't think if somebody has stolen Dr. Burns' DEA number and is writing scripts on it, you don't think that should be discoverable?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I'm not sure that's the point I'm making. I'm trying to emphasize that many of the pieces of what's proposed here are moving away from the original intent and finding other uses for this data that I think we'll see throughout some of the comments I'm making that may be helpful but are not consistent with where we were originally meant to go with the database. I will mention this is not one of our high priority pieces that I'm in opposition to. Just to move along, allowing disclosure to the state medical examiner, I just mostly had a question. I'm not exactly sure what medical legal investigations are, so maybe that's something that I can discuss offline.
Rob, do you want to address that?
Chair Monis-Anderson, yeah, the state medical examiner is given specific authority in the criminal code to investigate all deaths, unattended deaths, as well as local medical examiners. So they're responsible for investigating why people died. In many cases, those involve medical questions, also legal questions, because in some cases they can result in homicide prosecutions, a variety of things. So the medical examiner is actually a part of the Oregon State Police for that reason. So it's more of a forensic medical examination, if you like to watch those kind of TV shows, and it is medical legal in that sense. And that's the way I would refer to our medical examiner just generically.
Chair Monis-Anderson, I think that's something I would love to discuss offline and a little bit confused. So I'll move on. In regard to the disclosure to a public health authority, again, I'm not sure why we're not honestly as concerned about this piece because the disclosure is of de-identified data, so we're not identifying individual patients. I think I'm more confused why it's seen that it's not available, that information isn't available to local public health authorities now under the current law. Again, it's something I can follow up.
Do you want to address that, Tom?
I don't want to pick, Madam Chair, members. There are times when public health officers believe or are aware or assume that there may be problems going on in their county. And by being able to get this data and to be able to actually come in and look at the data that is going on inside their county will give the public health officers a tool in which they may use to go in and help try and slow down an epidemic, try and stop an epidemic, try and identify where the problems may be occurring within their county.
But it's aggregate data, so.
It's aggregate data. It is not, yeah.
And we do have a terrible abuse of drugs in the state, and this is one tool where strategies could be developed in helping them combat the drug abuse within their county, as I interpret it.
Correct.
And if I might add, Madam Chair, I think Becky's question, legitimately so, is why couldn't they get this right now? And that's because we so narrowly crafted our current statutes that the way OHA interprets the statutes, the way I interpret the statutes, they can't get it right now, even though it's de-identified data. It's information we should be able to provide to our public health officers to give them an idea of what's going on in their county generically. Technically, I don't think OHA can give them that right now.
Thank you.
Moving on to sections 3 and 4, in regard to the public records disclosure, this just provides to me another opportunity to reiterate the uncertainty of the time we're in regard to the lawsuit with DEA, and I think that that provides a special circumstance in many ways for a patient to want to know which providers are in the system. In that, I think that information could be helpful for someone who really believes that their private medical information may be at risk. The public should have a right to know which practitioners are participating in the program. That's our point in regard to that one. Most that would really only be the information under 431.966 that would include information identifying the recipient of the information. Of course, information from 431.964 is already exempt from public record. So really just talking about the second piece of that provision proposed in sections 3 and 4. And then I'd like to move on to the amendments and just take a moment to highlight that these are probably the our point of highest concern in regard to the proposal to expand the prescription drug monitoring program. The Dash 1 amendment would give the Board of Pharmacy rulemaking authority to add any prescription drug to the program. As I said, this is probably the most threatening in our view to the privacy of the patients in the database. There was a lot of discussion in 2009 about which drugs would be a part of the system, and I know that the legislature settled on controlled substance schedule 2, 3, and 4. This would open up not only to a whole new group of Oregonians, and I actually would be interested to know how many more people might be subject to this monitoring if we open it up to really any prescription drug that the Board of Pharmacy chooses. But I would also say if that's the case, if this really is something that the committee wants to do, that we might do so in statute and really have a comprehensive and thoughtful discussion about which drugs these might be, as opposed to leaving it to the rulemaking process. Moving on to the Dash 3 amendment, which seems to be setting up some type of alert system or enabling the PDMP to set up an alert system to notify doctors and pharmacists of multiple prescriptions. I think we have a couple concerns here. One, that the standard seems pretty vague in terms of when the notification would happen. Potentially dangerous, I think, leaves a lot of room for interpretation. Raises some concerns as well around which patient information is being shared. Again, if we're opening it up to prescription drugs that are not controlled substances, that there are certainly in our Oregon law requirements about patient consent before certain private health information can be shared. And so I think that might be implicated here. And then finally, I think there's a broader concern back to the original intent of the bill. In 2009, this bill was being discussed as a tool to curb doctor shopping. I think that what the Dash 1 and even the Dash 3 do is move us a little bit more into drug monitoring, medication monitoring, much like a medical record might be. And I'm not sure the system is equipped to do that. I'm not sure that was ever the intent of the program. And so again, in light of the DEA lawsuit, we're just worried about more information, more sharing, increasing the scope of the function of the program. Finally, in regard to the Dash 3, I do have some concerns as well about what it would mean when a practitioner does get an alert or a pharmacist does get alert. Is that practitioner or pharmacist then obligated to act on it? And what happens if something happens to the patient? Is the practitioner or pharmacist liable for that? I know there are some protections in current law around immunity, and I think we would just want to think carefully about providing more information but still maintaining immunity for those practitioners. It seems to be a tough balance to navigate. And then finally, the Dash 7 amendment. I realize this is a pretty narrow piece around sharing with different states. Senator Cruz cited the reference in the current law around a prohibition against inter-system sharing unless those states with which we are sharing have the same privacy protections that we do. Of course, Washington, Idaho, and California do not have many of the privacy protections that we do, including notifications to patients, warrant requirement, et cetera, et cetera. My concern about sharing in the way that is proposed now, one, again, that some of these sidebars would be left to agency rulemaking. I think that if we want sidebars, we should contemplate them in statute. but then second, I'm not sure where the accountability is then for the practitioners in other states for misusing the system. And that's all in regard to each of the sections. If I could just take a moment again and reiterate, we're very nervous about doing anything to expand either the scope or the purpose of this database at this time when we really don't know whether the information is secure. And as a point of process, if I may, just request to the committee that you consider putting off a work session until Senator Sanders Hayward has an opportunity to review the minutes from the hearing. Thank you.
Great. Senator Cruz?
Thank you. A couple of your points about, for example, allowing the Board of Pharmacy to decide which drugs below Schedule 2 would be included, and you say we ought to put it in statute, that is incredibly messy, and quite honestly, my faith in the Board of Pharmacy to actually know more about these drugs than I do is relatively high. And so I think that's the appropriate place for it. And as far as the sideboards around how the notification is going to happen, at this point in time, and I'd be more than happy to review the protocols once Mr. Burns has created them. But at some point in time, trying to put stuff in statute that is better in rule just makes things messier than it needs to be. And we will have a conversation about the protocols as far as what triggers alerts. And at this point in time, I'm relatively comfortable with that. And as far as the providers in other states, that once again, we'll have protocols written as to how that made me nervous too on the front end of it, because I went the same place you did. We're losing control of this information, but my sense is that this committee, we will review all the protocols that are developed, and I think it will be crafted, and if you don't do this right, Tom, I'll be after you, but you're going to put some pretty tight parameters around the ability for somebody from a provider from the state of Washington to be able to get the data and what they can actually do with it when they have it, whether they actually have possession. So, you know, I understand, Becky, your concerns on these areas. I just think we're better off letting rules be written and making sure the rules meet what we're after, rather than try to put stuff in statute that is going to potentially, you know, I mean, you know, the Board of Pharmacy is going to do this, and, you know, as soon as we put something in statute, there's a new Schedule 1 drug comes out, and what do we do, sort of thing. So, I understand the caution in this thing, but I think that our conversations that we have had, I think that the administrative process is going to work appropriately to give us the security we need.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Senator Cruz and Tom and District Attorney Bovette for all their work on it, and Becky for your analysis on it. And while I might not be able to get to yes on it, I think the fact that you put so much time into it, going to Montgomery, Alabama in the middle of the summer, is really much appreciated, and I just wanted to put that on the record, so thanks.
And we had to wait clear till the last day before we had actually really Southern food. I mean, it was the last morning we had grits.
We need to move on. What I would like is for Rob and Tom to look at the concerns that ACLU brought forward. You know, there's possibly some changes maybe that we could make regarding source of payment is the one that just stood out for me. I don't think the timing is an issue because that's in the courts, and this is what we need right now. But again, the public record disclosure piece, as well as the accountability piece from the other states, you know, what are the parameters that providers in Idaho and California and Washington have that would be different? I mean, Becky alluded that there would be.
Chairman Sanderson, if you are a provider in Washington and want to get into the system, you must meet all of Oregon's requirements.
Okay.
They will be treated no differently than any other provider who currently practices in Oregon.
Okay, and then the final thing, thank you for clarifying that. Will the pharmacists have to act on an alert? Is that going to be taken care of in rule on what happens when they see that?
Chair Mona Sanderson, that's already taken care of an existing statute. The doctors and pharmacists insisted in 2009, and I concurred, that they be given blanket immunity from using or not using the PDMP. We gave them that blanket authority because we wanted, frankly, to not impose a requirement that they use it or not use it, as the case may be. So someone may get an alert from the system. If the doctor chooses to do nothing with it and hit delete, they're immune.
That's
if, they,
okay.
if they choose to look at it and it makes a difference, they're immune. With regard to the Board of Pharmacy, please know that the Board of Pharmacy, you have given plenary authority to schedule drugs. They can add, tramadol is a perfect example, widely abused right now. It's a prescription drug, not a controlled substance. Probably should be a controlled substance, but we're not there yet. The Board of Pharmacy tomorrow, after they go through rulemaking process, of course, could add that to schedule 2, 3, or 4.
Yep.
Instantly making it part of the PDMP. But maybe we're not ready for that. Maybe we're ready to add it to the PDMP, but not go the full panoply of controlled substances, which raises the criminal penalties, raises a whole lot of administrative requirements on pharmacists in terms of dispensing and security and all kinds of other issues. There are gradations of how we treat drugs. So this is just giving the Board of Pharmacy the authority to do what they already have the authority to do now, except not go the next extent and schedule them as controlled substances. So I don't know what modification I can make to that, because this is just giving the Board of Pharmacy an intermediate authority instead of going the full meal deal.
Madam Chair, in my opinion,
I think that is written the way it should be, and I agree with Rob. We don't need to be adding additional criminal penalties just because we would have to reschedule a drug that we think, that the Board of Pharmacy thinks is worth tracking. And it's not just that it may be a drug that has adverse effects in and of itself, but it could have adverse effects in combination with other drugs. So
okay, we need to move on. So I would like to close the public hearing because you've been given direction on a Senate Bill 470 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 366. Can you tell us what this one's all about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 366 comes to us from Senator Bate. It requires insurers to pay indemnities under the health insurance policy directly to the providers of the health services.
All right, and who goes first?
Greg Miller.
Okay, Greg Miller.
Goes first, and then we go.
And then you, we'll call up
your
the
panel.
Rest, your panel.
Right. And then it'll be Keisha, this guy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Miller. I represent the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. The reason OASCA, if I may call them OASCA, requested the bill before you today is that in some cases, the surgery centers that I represent today provide a service to patients that have out-of-network benefits within their insurance policy. But to get paid for that service, ASCs have to track that payment down, not from the insurer, but from the patient who received those services. This adds administrative costs to the surgery centers. It adds a headache to the patient and overall burden to a system that's based upon maximum efficiency and quality of care to the patient. This bill does one logical thing. It says, if we provide a service, pay us for that service, and don't make us track that down through the different courses through the patients that they see in those facilities. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, but would also defer to the panel that will be up in front of you before you.
I think let's go with the panel because we want to contain this to about 20 minutes.
Got it.
So Keisha Norling and is it Evelyn?
Evelyn.
Okay, and
Jonathan Sherman.
Jonathan Sherman.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, and members of the committee, my name is Keisha Norling. I am a registered nurse and healthcare administrator. I represent the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association as the immediate past president, and I'm also the administrator of Northwest Ambulatory Surgery Center, a joint venture surgery center in downtown Portland, Oregon, owned by Legacy Health Systems, United Surgical Partners International, which is a surgery center management company, and 17 physician owners. I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 366. Currently, there are two large national insurance companies and one moderate-sized Oregon, Washington-based insurance company that are sending reimbursement checks directly to patients who are treated by out-of-network providers. This is a controversial practice that has been examined across the United States, and bills have been passed in states such as Florida to prevent this practice. ERISA, which is the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, has language that's been interpreted by many to prohibit these payments directly to patients. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act incorporates or adopts existing federal law, ERISA, for all group and individual health plans to mandate unconditional acceptance of valid patient assignments for disbursement of reimbursement checks directly to the designated health care provider, regardless of their network participation. It is common practice for patients to sign an assignment of benefits prior to being seen by a health care provider. Approximately 70% of insured working Americans paid higher premiums for out-of-network coverage and rights to see non-participating providers on usual and customary rate fee schedules. These numbers indicate that Americans value this option. Administrative processes should not become overly burdensome for patients who pay extra for this product. The majority of patients do not want to receive their checks directly from the insurance company. They find health care to be confusing enough as it is, and this is an extra burden placed on them that is not appreciated. Patients do not want to be in the middle of provider and insurance company negotiations. These payments directly to patients have been used as leverage by the insurance companies to pressure providers into joining networks. However, today, the ability to negotiate a contract that will cover costs, let alone allow for even a small profit, is almost impossible. A surgery center administrator recently stated that it took her center 14 months to renegotiate an existing insurance contract, and that was with the assistance of a professional negotiation company. That company stated they had never experienced a more difficult and discouraging renegotiation experience. Personally, our hospital partner has been negotiating on our surgery center's behalf with two of these three insurance companies who send checks to out-of-network providers. And these negotiations have been going on for 6 months so far, and little has been accomplished. The process has been slow and frustrating, with little communication from the insurance company. Their excuse, five of their six provider contractors quit at the same time. Many surgery centers have been told by one of the largest insurance companies in the state that they have no desire to contract with surgery centers. On the other hand, this insurance company's legal counsel will tell state legislators that all they want is for providers to sign contracts. These direct payments to patients increase health care administration costs. Our collections expert spends approximately 20 to 28 hours every month dealing with checks that are sent to patients. 17 patients, making up 3% of our patients covered by our largest out-of-network payer, were sent to collections in 2012 because they kept their check sent to them by their insurance company. That makes up $112,294 placed in patients' hands that was not taxed like regular income. In addition, some patients cash their insurance check, then pay the surgery center with a credit card, and then they deduct this amount as a medical expense on their taxes. One patient told us she was applying for a home loan, so she cashed the check and deposit it so it appeared she had more money in the bank and increased her chances of getting the loan. More alarmingly, young adults over 18 are often caught between divorced parents. The father of one of our patients cashed the check meant to pay for his son's surgery. The young adult and his mother were not able to get the money from his father, and ultimately, the young adult is the one who has sent to collections because he is considered to be responsible for the account. These stories occur every single week. The majority doesn't end up in collections, but it's because of the diligence of our business office, and it is an expensive and labor-intensive process that should not be necessary. Healthcare is changing. There is an emphasis on transparency. Meaningful changes will not be successful unless fair and consistent business practices are implemented across the country. I know surgery centers in rural parts of the state that have negotiated reasonable contracts with the same companies that won't return our phone calls in Portland. If we can't get contracts, we should at least be able to provide our quality and efficient services in an environment that still promotes efficiencies in healthcare. Sending checks to patients increases administrative burden and places patients in compromising positions. Patients should not be used as pawns in the negotiations of contracts. Thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Let's go through the panel first.
Senator Mona Sanderson, other senators, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm Jonathan Sherman. I'm a neurosurgeon in Eugene, Oregon, and an owner of Spine Surgery Center of Eugene. Spine Surgery Center of Eugene was opened about 5 years ago with the goals of providing excellent surgical care, reducing costs for patients, implementing the highest standard of care available through careful selection of equipment and spinal devices and personnel in the operating room, and to provide a great workplace for staff members. Since we've opened, we've exceeded these goals with superior certification surveys, our patient satisfaction rates averaging above 95%, and exceedingly low complication rate when compared to national standards. We find it therefore astonishing that major insurance companies declined to offer realistic contracts to our surgery center. Our charges are always lower than hospitals, and hospitals get paid at about 80% of what their charges are by insurance companies. Yet when we are offered our contracts, despite our initial charges being lower, we're offered rates at 25% of our charges, which would represent significantly less than of one quarter of what the hospital charges, and quite a deal less than what the insurers already pay hospitals, and they do not even come close to covering our costs. And then when we do not sign those, when we do not go in-network, we are surprised that we are penalized after that by them sending payments for the surgeries to our patients, and that leads to us losing money on that individual surgery and makes it that much more difficult for us to continue to offer low-cost, high-quality care to our patients. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Evelyn Cole, and I'm the CEO of Kuiper Spine, which is in Eugene, which is a neurosurgical practice. I'm also the administrator for Spine Surgery Center in Eugene. When we do not contract with a patient's health insurer, the patient has a couple of options. They can go to the hospital and have their surgeries done there, or they can use our surgery center, which remains out of network. They are penalized by paying a higher personal payment for the service that they opt to take in our surgery center. And we've tried to negotiate these contracts with our insurers. Sometimes we are able to. For the most part, we do have contracts, but there are few who offer us contracts below our cost. Spine surgery is a very expensive surgery. Fusions can cost around $50,000, and we are trying to do the best we can for our patients by offering them lower cost and higher quality of care. When we don't sign an insurance contract, the insurer penalizes us by sending our payments to the patients, or to the insured, who is not always the patient. Recently, insurers have stopped sending explanations of benefits with these payments as well. So the patient gets a check. They have no idea exactly what it's supposed to cover. They know that we sent the bill, but they don't get an explanation from their insurer about the check that they receive. We've tried several tactics to circumvent the problems with the patients getting our checks. We have the patient sign a contract, and we alert them ahead of time that they will be getting this check, and tell them that if they bring the check to us, we will match their inpatient benefits so that we write off the difference that they pay for an out-of-panel facility. We've also asked patients to sign notarized statements that go with our claims to the insurance company directing them to send the checks to us. Insurers just disregard these powers of attorney. We've been forced on occasion to file medical liens because we have put out thousands of dollars in implants that we don't get reimbursed for because the checks have gone to the patients. There are also complications from the insurance company's policy that affect our patients. Being in Eugene, we have a number of students who are covered under their parents' insurance plans, and those parents live out of state, or sometimes in one case, we have one student whose parent lived in New York. The check went to the parent in New York, and despite our calling the parent and the student calling the parent, the check was not turned to us. So we were forced to turn that patient over to collections, even though it wasn't at her own fault. It was something that she could not control. We have divorced patients where the ex-spouse, the decree of divorce requires the ex-spouse to carry the insurance, but the spouse that is divorced is the patient. So when those checks go to the spouse that was not the patient, they're not really inclined to send that check to pay for their ex-spouse's medical bills. We have a current patient who was sent a check for $48,000 that was sent to pay for her spine surgery, and it went to her spouse. We had to hire an attorney and file a complaint in court to get a judgment against the ex-spouse in order to garnish his wages for the check that he had kept. When overpayments occur, which they do, those overpayments go to the patient who may have brought that check to us in payment of their bill. So now the insurance company comes back to the patient and wants the overpayment returned to them. They come back to us. We have nothing in writing from the insurance company that says there was an overpayment or what the overpayment was, why the overpayment occurred. The patient is caught in the middle of this vicious triangle of trying to figure out, was the surgery actually overpaid, and how do they get this money and get it returned to the insurance company? Lost checks. We've had a number of situations where an insurance check was lost, and the insurance company puts on their websites on occasion when the check has been released. So we will go to the patient and say, this check has been released from your insurer. It should be coming to you in a couple of days. The check may or may not show up, and when it doesn't show up, the patient will say to us, I never received the check. They go back to their insurance company. They declare that they sent the check, but the patient never received it. So in one case, we had a patient whose HR department at his employer got involved, and 2 months later, it was discovered that the check was sitting in an insurance company in a clerk's desk, and the check had never been sent. Found money. One of the things that really is disturbing is that we have a lot of patients who may have been out of work because of a back injury. And so when this check comes to them, if their average income is $25,000 a year and they get a $50,000 check, that's 2 years' income. And many have told us, I have to take care of my family first. I have to pay my house payment so I don't lose my house. I have to buy food for my family in lieu of making the medical payment. We stand totally in support of this bill, and we're asking you to support it as well, because what it does is increase health care costs because our administrative costs go up, and it causes an adversarial relationship between us and our patients because we are kind of in the middle of this cloud, and we can't pin down who has the money and where to go to get it. Thank you.
Well, you certainly made the case, described the issue very clearly. Is there any questions? All right. Thank you very much. And let us call Kim Guest and Elise Brown.
Kim, will you go?
Oh, never mind. Just Kim Guest, and then we'll have the next three. And we're running over, so please.
I'll be short.
Thank you.
My name is Kim Guest, and I'm the administrator for Summit Orthopedics in Portland, Oregon. My doctors do all of the trauma surgery for Emanuel Hospital, the orthopedic trauma surgery. I agree completely with everything they just said. I have a few other examples of patients that have gotten the payments. They've bought boats. They've bought stoves. They say, well, I spent that money. I mean, they act like they don't know why they got it in the first place. We had one instance where we were contracted, and the payment went to the patient. So we called the insurance company on it, and they said, oh, we made a mistake. You'll have to recoup that from them. And I said, no, you made the mistake. You need to send the check to us. Well, not until we get the check back. And, I mean, it's just this constant. It's a real burden because a lot of times we don't even know that the payment was sent to the patient. And because of our practice, most of our patients, our clinics are post-op patients. We don't even see them before we treat them. So we don't even have the opportunity. If they need surgery, they have surgery. So we don't even know if they have an insurance that... We deal with a lot of out-of-state insurance, too, because of people that get in accidents here in Oregon, and they're from out-of-state. So that's all.
All right. Thank you so much for coming and sharing. All right. Now, Elise Brown, Tom Holt, and Allison Goldwater.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And on behalf of AHIP and our Oregon members, we're here today to oppose Senate Bill 366. This is another bill that we've discussed in committee that challenges affordability for those in the system. So with me today, I have one of my Oregon members, Regents, and I'm going to let them get into the meat of the bill.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We're here in opposition to Senate Bill 366. The bill essentially, from our point of view, demands that we would reward providers as if they're in-network, but release them from all the obligations that come with being in-network. There are two core issues here for us. One, if providers do not need to join our networks in order to get paid directly at network rates, that undermines our ability to build cost-effective networks for our members. And you'll hear from Allison in a minute, but we do contract with most providers in this state, at least those who are willing to be reasonable about their rates. Secondly, there's no protection in this bill for a member of ours for the balance of charges between our network rate and what the provider may choose to charge. Those rates can be dramatically higher than what we would reimburse in-network because, frankly, there are specialists who game the system in that way. And they do exist, and that's one of the reasons that we have contracting networks is to protect our members so when they go see a provider, the charge that is paid is payment in full, and they have no further obligation beyond what their policy may call for as far as co-payments and so on. I think it's important to center, given that you've heard from ambulatory surgical centers, on how this actually happens. You have two parties involved here, both of whom have decided to operate outside our network. Our member, for whatever reason, for a planned service, has chosen to go to an out-of-network provider. We contract with most of the ASCs. I went to a very fine one last summer and got a shoulder fixed. And, one of the first things they did when I was checking in with them was they were very, very thorough about payment, as well they should be. Secondly, you have a provider that's choosing not to contract with us. And we believe we offer very competitive rates for providers to provide the service. This happens relatively rarely, and you'll hear this from Allison. And I'll turn it over to Allison Goldwater, who is in charge of our provider contracting for the state of Oregon.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide my perspective on why Regents opposes Senate Bill 366. I'd like to start with talking about generally we see three groups of providers.
You need to say your name for the record.
Oh, my apologies. Allison Goldwater.
Generally, we see three groups of providers. Those that are forward-thinking, primary care and specialty providers who are actively working with us to change the care delivery and reimbursement models. We're working closely with Dr. Amon out of the Schnitzer Diabetes Center at OHSU to create better care delivery for intensive type 1 diabetic patients. And ultimately, that's going to reduce the cost of care and increase the capacity of that center. And we're working with many other examples of providers that fundamentally want to help us all change the system and make healthcare more affordable. There are those providers that are just working really hard, that have their heads to the ground to deliver care. They don't have the time to engage right now, but they're ready and willing to follow what the others figure out for them. But bills like this one and others in other committees, from our point of view, represent efforts to resist reform, protect personal bottom lines instead of engaging in conversations about how to fix this system. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about the difference between in-network and out-of-network providers. When we have providers that are in-network, we credential them. We validate that they have the appropriate accreditations from Medicare or others. We validate them and compare them against the national quality databanks to ensure that there are no issues involved. When they're out of network, we don't have the opportunity to do this, and therefore we can't validate to our membership that they have providers that have passed our credentialing. Providers who are contracted also agree to accept our rates, payment in full. Our rates are very competitive in the marketplace, in many cases higher than what some of our competitors might pay. Members are protected from what I call balance billing, the difference between what we negotiate as a contracted rate and what they charge as retail. And in some cases, these charges are 8, 9, 10 times what Medicare might pay. And when they're out of network, these specialists, there are some specialists that are intentionally not contracting because they can contract. Because they can charge these rates and collect higher payments from their patients. There are examples of providers who intentionally stay out of network, collect high payments from insurance carriers, and then write the difference off from some members, knowing that they've been able to circumvent that system. Paying members directly does a couple of things. Come to renegotiate an agreement and charge in this day and age or ask and demand for 25 and 30% increases in care in rates, they might terminate their agreement, send us a letter that says we want a 25% rate increase, and if you don't give that to us, we're going to terminate our contract. Having that that incentive for them to say, if you do that, the payment is going to go to the members, is an incentive for them to stay in network. We agree that it is something that it puts a barrier in place, but it also gives the member the opportunity to negotiate with that provider, to understand what they're paying for, and be able to ask the question, why am I paying this much more money than what you would have paid if you were under contract? It allows us to have conversations with providers and try to maintain them in our network. I think the other thing that I'd want to say is, you know, to Tom's point, we have a very low out-of-network rate. Our total claim spend is probably 99% in-network, somewhere in that range. So where there is out-of-network, it's not because we haven't offered contracts, and it's not because we're not willing, at least generally. There may be some small cases for quality issues. But generally, we're trying to create a network that's got breadth and has depth and offers everybody across the state of Oregon an opportunity to see in-network providers. But we need to do that at a rate that protects affordability.
I do have a question regarding most ambulatory surgical centers, from what I gather from talking to the providers themselves, are much less than what happens in the hospital. And I'll take an example. My father was with Providence. He had cataract surgery. The physician had an ambulatory surgical center where he could have gone, or the hospital. But because the same physician, so the credentialing wouldn't have been a problem, the provider told me, you know, it would be better if you would just come to the ambulatory surgical center, but I am not in that plan, and therefore I have to do the surgery at Providence Hospital, which is about $8,000 more or $6,000 more than if you came to my ambulatory surgical center. So I think that's, those are the issues. I know payment, this just deals with payment, but I know the argument comes from you that ambulatory surgical centers would be paying a higher rate. And I guess I would think some plans, and I'm only, not Regents, but with Providence, they want the patient to come to their hospital for market share. And so I think that's an issue that we need to address, even though payment is a different issue.
Thank you, Chairman Anderson, Chairwoman Anderson. And I don't disagree with you that ambulatory surgery centers generally offer a lower cost alternative than to have surgeries, clinically appropriate surgeries, in hospitals. Unfortunately, the providers that choose to remain out of network generally rival the costs of delivering care in hospitals. And it's it is substantial. At times, there are substantial rate increases that are being demanded when they are contracted with threats to terminate, which do continue to increase the cost of care from where we stand today.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you very much for being here, Ms. Goldwater. And so my first question is, is Regents one of those providers that sends out checks without explanation of benefits?
We do not send checks out without explanations of benefits. However, most of them are now available electronically. So a payment may go with a note to go to their online member portal to print an explanation of benefits.
Can you help me understand, if you're sending out a check, which is a couple of pieces of paper, why you wouldn't send the explanation of benefits? Is that a barrier set up so that the person isn't capable of easily looking and comparing?
No, that's not the intent. The intent was to provide sustainability and administrative cost reductions in printing paper versus printing versus providing an electronic means of accessing the information.
Yeah, I'll take you at your word on that.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Shields, if I could add just to that, no one has to go online to see their explanation of benefits at this point in time unless they have opted into getting their information that way. So only those people that have self-identified that's the way they want to access information would get that kind of communication.
Then can I ask a follow-up? Elise, could you check in with your members to find out if any of them are not sending out EOBs, because I think the one issue is whether or not, you know, the check should go straight to the person, but it seems almost unconscionable that you would send a check for $4,500 without having a simple breakdown of, you know, what the overall rate was asked for the provider, how much is covered, and then what that difference might be.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, I'd be happy to do that. I don't know off the top of my head which of the other members are doing it that way. Happy to get back to you.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Could I ask one
yes,
last question?
Please.
So, again, Ms. Goldwater, usually I pick on Tom, but since you stuck your chin out,
I can take it.
This is nothing personal. So my understanding in a lot of these, you know, kind of high-dollar procedures, my understanding is, and I might not have the terminology right, but basically providers by Oregon law can write down to what the contracted rate would be, and there's nothing illegal for a provider to do that. And it seems like if they're going to write down to what the contracted rate is going to be anyway, that your argument about them being 6, 7, or 8 times more expensive doesn't hold as much water in those instances.
I don't know that they're writing down to the level of contracted reimbursement. I don't know that was not what I intended to say,
nor
do I know that that's what they're doing.
I mean, my experience having talked to some of these providers is that's what they do, so that they, I guess, what they're arguing is we're not 8, 9, 10 times higher, and I don't know if you have some evidence that ambulatory surgery centers are asking these outlandish prices. I'd love to see it.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Shields, this has been the subject of national investigations. Where this can happen is if a carrier, and we're not one of them, has out-of-network benefits to pay based on a percentage of billed charges, and that opens up the opportunity for an unscrupulous provider to basically inflate billed charges in order to take advantage of that. So then when they write down to the out-of-network benefit, it's actually quite a lot of money, more than what would be paid ordinarily in that kind of case. We operate our contracts differently. We operate our contracts on a different kind of schedule, a flat schedule, so we can predict the cost.
And then finally, Madam Chair, if I can. So, I mean, you'll concede that a big part of the reason why you do this is to discourage people from going out of network.
I would suggest that it's not an intentional encouragement or discouragement to go out of network, but it is a protection put in place for those members to be able to negotiate reasonable fees for the services they've chosen to seek out of network.
Okay. What I'd like the proponents of the bill, you heard the opposition and some of the statements that they have made regarding bill charges and credentialing and what was the other? I think, and the comparison of out-of-network charges versus in-network charges. It'd be nice to actually have some of those figures. Okay. We're really running behind, and I know that. I know. So, Josh. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 366. And can you get 10 minutes on 376? Okay, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 376. And I don't know if we need Greg Miller, but we really want to get to the crux of the issue regarding with Terry Fitzpatrick, Gwenton Dayton first. And please, it's really important for us to get to Senate Bill 572 also. And so I'm really going to cut you off. This is a public hearing. We can go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senators, my name is Terry Fitzpatrick. I am the administrator of the Oregon Urology Institute in Springfield, Oregon. We have two sites in Springfield, a site in Roseburg, and a site in Florence. And I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 376.
And Sandy, you didn't describe it. I didn't let you do that. Sorry.
No. Madam Chair, this bill prohibits restrictions on health practitioners' self-referrals other than the requirement to notify the patient that a health practitioner has financial interest in the referral. This has an emergency clause and is effective on passage.
Thank you.
Okay. The Oregon Urology Institute, in addition to our sites in the world of urology, we deal with issues of bladder, kidney, prostate, testicular cancers, and incontinence. Within our group, we have 21 providers, 15 docs, 5 PAs, a physical therapist. We have obviously a physical therapy department, we have a radiation department, we have an imaging center, we have an ambulatory surgery center, and an incontinence department, so we have a variety of services. The Senate Bill 376 really does two things. One, it puts Oregon law in line with federal law on self-referrals. In our business, we call it the Stark Laws. Stark has a whole requirement of how you handle ancillaries, how the profits are distributed, a tremendous amount of regulation in there that we all follow. This bill would mirror that. And in addition, it gives clear direction to the OHA not to make any rules limiting in-office ancillary exceptions. To give you a background, what an in-office ancillary exception is if you go to a physician office. A one or two physician office may or may not have an x-ray unit. A group of whatever number has the ability, because you were a group, to get an exception to provide those ancillary services. Over the last, say, 3 years, there's been a lot of work nationally and in the state to begin to try to take away that in-office ancillary exception. Most of that is anecdotal evidence that says, look, if you just gave all this business to us. We'd be more cost-effective. We'd provide better quality. There's only one study I'm aware of that was done by MedPAC that Gwen will get involved in to give you more detail that tells you that the in-office ancillary exception has found that it will not. If you take it away, it will not reduce costs, and it will eliminate the ability to integrate care. The couple of just an example of kind of tell you how it works in my world. We have in our physical therapy department, we use physical therapy to as an avenue before going to surgery. And most of it is for, say, female incontinence. A personal buddy of mine, his mother-in-law was going to have surgery in a different office. And I said, you know, before she has surgery, why don't you get a second opinion? Why don't you come to the office here? She did. She went to one of our urologists to physical therapy, and after four visits, didn't need surgery. And if the in-office ancillary exception was taken away, we would not be able to provide that service and a specialty, the pelvic floor specialty, which we're the only provider in Lane County, would be gone. I think that would just be ridiculous. The other one that we have is take an example of a kidney stone. Patient will go to an emergency room, have pain, urologist will get involved, said, well, if you haven't eaten, come on over to the office. We can do a CT scan. We can look and see if you have stones. We can take you to our surgery center. We can take care of you that day. Should that be gone, this one day where you're in intense pain could be a 3 or 4 day process. It eliminates the ability to integrate care. It just doesn't make sense these days. I think I have a little bit more, but in interest of time, unless there's any questions.
Thank you, Gwen. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the OMA's General Counsel, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'll just make a few points. First, it is true that the issue of referral within healthcare is governed by a couple of federal laws. Stark, of course, has been referenced, also the anti-kickback laws. And there are what are known as safe harbors or exceptions within both of those laws for referral by physician to of patients to an ambulatory surgery center in which they might have an interest. Those safe harbors, as all federal law typically is, are complex. I'm glad probably at some later date if there's interest in the nature of those exceptions to go into them. But my point in raising it is this has been regulated on the federal level, and these laws, especially Stark, frankly, are constantly changing and constantly being evaluated. And for states to try to align their laws with or make changes to their state law and then keep up with federal law, I think can be challenging and ultimately I might say a fool's errand. I think that this is amply regulated on the federal level, and we are best our best course would be to simply let the federal law control rather than try to do more on the state level. I also, it's interesting when you think about the self-referral issue. Really, it's an attempt to regulate overutilization and control healthcare costs, something the OMA feels very strongly about and supports completely. But really, it's doing it in the context of fee-for-service, right? A system that rewards over-referral, over-utilization. But as Oregon moves forward with coordinated care organizations, that really is changing the game in terms of how we look at this issue, right? Hopefully, we're no longer rewarding volume, essentially. The money is the money, and we'll be paid what we have in the global budget. And so this issue of referral and trying to limit referrals as a way to limit overutilization perhaps is a system of an old era or an era that is changing, perhaps not gone but changing. And when we think about this issue, which again the OMA agrees it's a priority of the state of Oregon as well as nationally to look at overutilization and referrals and overspending, but we should do it within the new model that Oregon is considering rather than the old model that we might be leaving. So with those comments, I'm glad to answer any questions.
All right. Other questions? Thank you very much. And Diane Godwin.
Good
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Diana Godwin. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. And in my private practice, I represent about 165 private practice physical therapy clinics in Oregon. I also represent about 185 in Washington, and I have done for a number of years. First thing I want to emphasize, I don't see this bill, Senate Bill 376, as in any way attacking or threatening to take away the in-office ancillary exception that we've always had under the Stark Law. You may be aware that unless somebody is saying that somehow the Oregon Health Authority is in fact threatening to do that in contravention to the Stark Law, I wasn't aware of that. You may be aware that in this committee I also have a Senate Bill 544 sponsored by the group I represent, which is the Oregon Physical Therapists and Independent Practice, and we have a bill to address the issue not of self-referral so much as and not trying to prohibit in any way a physician or a clinic having in-office ancillary services. Our bill just says that if you in fact own or have a financial interest in an ancillary service, that you just disclose that to the patient, which is the current law that's separately in Senate Bill or ORS 441. Our bill just goes a little bit further to say that you cannot restrict the patient. You cannot give them a limited referral that says you can only see physical therapy if you see that in our clinic. And so we're not prohibiting in any way somebody from having a physical therapist. In fact, my physical therapist in independent practice, I represent a number of clinics who do provide women's health services, particularly women's incontinence. And you could have a patient who has previously been to a physical therapist, a woman physical therapist for women's incontinence issues. And if they go to a center that says, well, we want you to have your physical therapy here, or we won't give you a referral for physical therapy, that's wrong, particularly if that woman has an established relationship with an independent practice physical therapist who they trust, who can deliver the care cost-effectively, who will work with the physician. That's all we're saying, is we're trying to protect patient choice. We're not trying in any way to prohibit physicians from having in-office ancillary services. Those can be very useful. But we have seen a lot of abuse by big hospital systems. I believe our chairman referenced one that says to their doctors, you must refer for physical therapy in-house. And doctors have been asked in their reviews, how many times have you referred outside Providence? And that's a concern. We also want to preserve the financial viability of our independent practice small businesses. That's one of our objectives. We have a lot of experienced small business private practices, physical therapy practices, who we hope will be participating actively as members in a CCO because they can deliver cost-effective care. They have a relationship with that patient. It's most beneficial to have that patient be able to go back to that provider. So, to say that the Oregon Health Authority, who is managing this system, should not have possibly the tool of saying, no, you need to allow referrals for patients. You need to allow patient choice to go to a provider who is also part of the CCO. I don't know that you'd want to take that away at this point from the Oregon Health Authority. So I'm happy to answer any questions. And referring to the MedPAC, if you look at the June 2010 MedPAC report, I think it's Chapter 12, it specifically talks about the concern about in ancillary office services with respect particularly to physical therapy. And I know they're looking at this because they have identified overutilization and excessive costs from in ancillary office service physical therapy. So, you know, we are looking at it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, and Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Diane, I appreciate you being here. I know that in imaging, it's been another big issue with the studies being pretty clear mm-hmm. that the correlation between self-referral and overutilization, it seems to me in the literature that I've read. We've got another bill that's addressing this in my committee also from the small business protection issue. But I think you know, I think there's room for compromise here that gets everybody happy that both people can really focus on patient choice. And I think that one of the things that I've seen in the literature, one of the only real ways that holds down the cost of healthcare or that's correlated with it is the experience of the provider.
Yes.
Those who, particularly in primary care providers that have been doing it for a longer time tend to ask for fewer things, fewer tests, et cetera. And so we want to make sure that we're not putting people out of business.
Absolutely.
And, you know, bringing up the next generation without making sure that those...
All we want to do is preserve patient choice and ensure that we're not driving our small businesses out of business. And our bill doesn't do that. Doesn't stop physicians from having an ancillary services.
You're talking about another bill, though. Not
Senate Bill 544, right.
Yeah, same. We're not discussing that today. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Diana. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 376 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 572. And I know Felisa and... Higgins, and then Bill Borwegan is on the phone. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chairman.
And then Angel Garris, do you want to come up?
And while they're coming up, Madam Chair, Senate Bill 572 requires hospitals to implement and establish requirements for a safe patient handling policy, requires workers' compensation rates take into consideration any anticipated reduction in loss of costs resulting from these plans and policies.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director at SEIU Local 49. I'd like to start out just updating folks on where we're at with the Senate Bill 572. We introduced the bill modeled after the state of Washington's bill. There are actually lots of amendments to come. So what I'd like to walk through today is our thinking around moving forward with safe patient handling in Oregon's hospitals and health systems, knowing that the piece of legislation you have in front of you needs some pretty hefty changes. You know, our hope in bringing this legislation forward is really to advance the practice of safe patient handling. You were given a little bit of the background about the dangers of it for healthcare workers and manual lifting, especially when it comes to nurses' aides. Orderlies is some of the language that's used. We call them transporters when it comes to patient mobility. According to the National Institute of Occupational Safety, the limit for lifting is 51 pounds for men and 46 pounds for women. So you can imagine trying to lift. Patients are much larger than that and are getting larger than that every day, unfortunately. Our hope with Senate Bill 572 is to move the culture of safe patient handling forward in all of our hospitals and health systems by creating a safe patient handling team that's made up of these direct care providers who manually lift, transport, and move patients when appropriate, a team that can assist and help educate other workers on best practices, that each healthcare facility will have a written and formalized process for safe patient handling, an adequate number of lift equipment that's well-maintained, and a trained staff to operate that equipment, and a program that will result in a reduction of injuries and adverse effects on patients. Like I said, these laws are being drafted and moved throughout the country. We hope that Oregon will be the last state on the West Coast to take this forward. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions, or we can move to Bill Borwegan, and he can answer questions.
Bill, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Borwegan. I'm the National Health and Safety Director for SEIU. We represent about a million healthcare workers in the U.S. and Canada, and we've been working for the last decade to support actions by state legislators to stem this epidemic of neck, back, and shoulder injuries caused by manual patient lifts and transfers, the leading cause of injuries and injuries to our nation's caregivers. Adopting safe patient handling programs will stem the
exodus of nurses from the bedside when they become disabled. It's going to help attract new nurses to the profession, improve the quality of patient care, reduce healthcare worker injuries, reduce workers' comp premiums and related medical costs, and save employers and taxpayers millions of dollars each year. Without these programs, the average nurse lifts 1.8 tons per day. It's the main reason that healthcare workers have higher injury and illness rates than workers employed in mining, manufacturing, or construction. When you ask nurses why they leave nursing, 12% say they leave the bedside due to disabling neck, back, or shoulder injury from manual patient lifting. Yet we know safe patient handling programs can dramatically cut these injuries. They can improve patient care as patients are less likely to be dropped on the floor. They incur fewer skin tears, and patients report feeling more comfortable and secure. Worker injuries also drop significantly. And the first state we worked in was in Washington State, and we got a law there passed in 2006 working with the legislature there. And it's the first law in the country that required employers to train and provide the equipment to their employees. And since that time, their workers' comp claims from neck, back, and shoulder injuries among their hospital workers have dropped by one-third. And safe patient handling equipment literally pays for itself in one healthcare facility that federal OSHA looked at. They spent $60,000 on the equipment, but within a year, they saw their medical and workers' comp costs cut by $600,000, literally a savings of $10 for every $1 invested in equipment. And this translates into an annual saving of $600,000 for each year that the program remains in place. The Safe Patient Handling Program saved both workers' backs and employers' bucks. Kaiser Permanente came to us in 2000 seeking our help to reduce their workers' comp costs. The vast majority of their reported injuries were neck, back, and shoulder injuries caused by manual lifting and transferring of patients. We work with them to implement programs in all their hospitals. As a 2006 Wall Street Journal article reported, one Oregon hospital, quote, bought 14 portable mechanical lifts, trained 700 nurses and assistants to use them, and ordered that no one raise, move, or lower a patient without the help of those motorized devices that work with a boom and sling. In 2 years, this hospital cut their worker injury rates by 29%. Safe patient handling laws have already passed in order in Texas, Washington State, Rhode Island, Maryland, Minnesota, Illinois, New Jersey, and most recently in California in the fall of 2011. North, south, and east of states have already acted. We strongly urge Oregon, the Oregon legislature, to follow suit to protect your state's health care workers. Thank you for this opportunity to share our views on this important matter. And I, as someone who's been working on this issue for 2 decades, I'm glad to respond to any questions and about our positive experience and support in supporting these worker and patient-friendly programs, and thank you for this opportunity.
Let's have Angel, and then we'll open up for questions.
Chair Moniz Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angel Garris. I am a member of SEIU Local 49, and I'm also a lift team member, safe team member from Kaiser Permanente. I've been doing that since the year 2000, almost seems like forever now, but close to 15 years. I am proud of the work we are doing to protect safety of the care, our caregivers and our patients. I travel throughout the hospital providing lift assistance and training. Our safe patient handling program was started 8 years ago with the purchase of lift equipment that transitioned into having a lift team and now a safe patient handling team that incorporates safety into safe patient handling. That includes patient mobility, staff mentoring, and training at the patient bedside, and identifying things that may be at risk to staff members. It is important to have a team that has a critical thinking skill and does lifting repetitively with machines. It's a necessary part of the team to make the patient the core of the focus and for those members to be engaged in the training and the committee. At Kaiser, we have one team per shift with one person on night shift. At Kaiser, we have seen a significant amount of reduction in injuries for our ICU staff, some of the most critical staff and patients in the hospital. All of our ICU nurses know how to use the equipment. The ICU nurses picked the equipment, and then they sent the team to the company for training. We have a room in our hospital that has two overhead lifts that has the capacity to hold 1,014 pounds. Unfortunately, it is necessary. Unfortunately, we don't have more, but we need more of those rooms. It's important in a safe patient handling policy to not get complacent until it becomes a habit. It is important that we have refreshers. It's critical that every year we do hands-on competency training because this is machinery. We have already seen the shortage of nurses Lifting puts so many people at risk doing the physicality of our job. We are a critical staff to the hospital, our community, and most important, our patients. If we all get broken, we can't show up for work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? This is an issue that's extremely important to me. I did home health for several years, not in this state, but in the state of Virginia, and had to go through extensive training because I had MS patients that were basically couldn't move themselves at all. And when you're trying to put in a catheter or you're trying to give an injection that needs to be a certain, they need to be in a certain position, it's extremely important to have the training, but then to also have the technology that we now have in helping us avoid some of these injuries. I don't see any other questions, but I would like to put this on the record. It's extremely important. Andy, can you come up? And then Mary Bakken, do you want to come up? But in this work group, there is a work group going on there. I know that Andy Easton would like to be on the work group, as well as Deb Fell Carlson from SAFE. They, of course, are the workers' comp, and they would like to be involved.
Chairman Sanderson, we would love it if you would help us to establish a work group with the folks who've outreached to you to craft the best bill possible.
Excellent.
We have a handful of folks that we've been working with, but would definitely like to expand that.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you. Andy, go ahead and maybe I can do one again. Oh, there she is.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, Andy Easton representing Oregon's 58 acute care community hospitals across the state. We are here today in support of the intent of the bill. I mean, the intent is to help provide and promote safe handling of patients, but also protect our direct care healthcare workers. We do have some concerns with the bill as it is written, and we look forward to working with SEIU and other proponents of the bill to make it more tolerable and acceptable to hospitals across the state. Few of our concerns include the lift equipment ratios to beds. It doesn't make sense for every single hospital. If you take in, for instance, a rural hospital in Heppner who has 17 beds that are licensed, an occupancy rate of 2% probably doesn't need two lifts in that hospital. Whereas Mercy, who has a hospital license of about 176 and an occupancy rate of 58%, they may need to have more than one lift in that facility. We also believe that there needs to be flexibility in the committees that are outlined in the statute. Having a committee outlined in statute makes it very hard for a hospital to have flexibility and to truly integrate the processes and policies that they would like to have across their hospital scope. And finally, we are a little confused as to why the scope of the relating clause was so narrow and only impacting hospitals. Now, we are not the only ones who have to deal with lifting patients and protecting our employees. We would like to see that expanded to include long-term care as well as ambulatory surgical centers. Again, we'd be willing to work with the proponents of the bill to come up with language that really truly promotes patient safety and healthcare worker safety, but it also needs to be broad spread across the hospital facility, and across the healthcare facility.
Thank you, Andy. Mary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Bakken, representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we, too, are generally in support of this bill. We actually think it's a good idea to handle patients correctly and safely. I am concerned, and I think the proponents are going to take care of my concern, which is that the funding mechanism is based on future workers' comp savings as they are captured, and I'm not sure that is one, legal, or two, possible. You know, I just think that might be a problem. And so I understand that they may be taking out Section 5, and that will answer any concerns that we have.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, with that, I won't call up SAFE, our workers' comp, because evidently they're saying they're going to take out, is that true, Felisa, taking out section, yeah, come forward, taking out, I forget what section, Section 5?
Five.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Felisa Higgins again from SEIU. We have several changes that have been suggested, including removing Section 5 of the bill, as well as working on some of the issues that Ms. Easton from the Hospital Association has raised around the committee structure. And we've also had a discussion about taking out the 1 to 10 ratio, which I believe was the Washington legislation. So we the changes that we have are more modeled after the New Jersey statute than the Washington statute. Washington was just the first, and it's the closest to us. So,
excellent. Well, then it looks like, yes, Senator Cruz.
The consideration of other sort of care facilities, have you considered that?
We have a, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have a very narrow relating to clause, but would require a new bill. But I think we're happy to have the discussion in our work group about moving forward. But I think for now, this is the bill we have so far. So,
okay.
I would encourage a broader discussion. We have committee bills that we could still use. So.
Madam Chair, again, Mary Botkin with AFSCME. We'd be interested in an expanded bill as well. We have a number of people who work in very challenging environments that would not be covered by the bill as it's currently written. And so, you know, if we could expand it.
All right. Well, right now the work group is going to be the Oregon Nurses Association, the Hospital Association, SAFE. They're very interested in it too, and we have the contact. And is AFSCME a part? Who else am I missing besides SEIU?
The Oregon Healthcare Ergonomics Association, OHE.
Oregon Healthcare Ergonomics Association. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Important topic. And colleagues, that's all that we have on the agenda right now. And so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 572, and we're adjourned.